Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Lucha Undead podcast. Before we start the show today, I'd like to ask you for a quick favor. Over the past few weeks, our show has been growing slowly but surely, and we'd like to ask you, the faithful listeners who listen to our show every week, to do us a favor and go on iTunes and leave us a review. Even if you don't listen to our show on the iTunes app, you don't even have to type anything. Just give us a few stars, however many stars you think we deserve. And if you can do that for us, that would be a huge help. It'll help spread awareness of our show. If we get enough likes, obviously, you know, we may even make it to the front page of iTunes, who knows. But if you could do us that little favor, that would be highly appreciated. So I will shut up now and we will go on with the show.
All right, so welcome to Lucha Undead Reborn. This is going to be a special edition of Get to Know PTBN PWO, but this is Voices of Wrestling edition. Yay. With special guest Jeff Hawkins.
Hi.
Hey, Jeff. So I've been trying to, when I do kind of trot out new different websites, different places, guests from there, to kind of get the head honchos of the places.
I am not that.
You are not the head honcho of Voices of Wrestling, and unfortunately, the reason why I pick you is because I actually have met you. I actually know you, Jeff, and we actually get along, so that's why I'm picking you to represent Voices of Wrestling. I'd love to have Rob, I'd love to have Rich, Joe, everybody else involved over there, even the guys who just do the writing, they don't are on podcasts. Mookie Ghana, who I found out listens to the show, which was really awesome for me. But I figured I'd start out with Jeff just because your improv background, you're a guy who I've had conversations with. So I figured you'd be a good start as dipping our toes into the Voices of Wrestling waters here, Jeff.
Outstanding.
Yeah, I don't know how familiar you are with this format or the show or what we're doing, but we're going to get to know you. We're going to talk to you, Jeff, the man behind Shake Them Ropes. But I guess we'll start out first with kind of like your involvement in the internet wrestling community. That's the whole thing. Have you ever been, or are you currently a member of the Communist Party? No.
The POW. Did you take money from Jack Abramoff?
Yeah. The PW forums. Have you ever been on there? Have you ever been involved in it?
I am a recent member of it. I've read them, but I've never been a member.
Okay.
Let's put it that way. Really an active member, just because I don't have a lot of time. I do a lot of my boarding, so to speak, at work, just to pass the time. And I have plenty of other boards I'm members of already. In terms of the internet wrestling community involvement, I've actually been on part of the IWC, quote unquote, since 1991. My first year of college, I got into Usenet-based user groups such as Rec Sport Pro Wrestling and things like that.
Is that going back to the old bulletin board days where it was like?
This is when the internet, the quote unquote internet, like Usenet and stuff, were pre AOL, pre bulletin boards being connected. I mean, it was basically colleges and military and government employees all talking to one another, and you could share information that way. But back then, when I was on it, it was all the guys that are now running their own sites. You know, Dave Shearer was a part of it. Bob Ryder was on there quite a bit. You had the guy who did news from Rick Skaya was on there. James, and all those guys, and it was really kind of an insidery type of place to be. And then when AOL hit it, and all those guys left to start their own things, which was interesting. But that's how I started really getting involved at least the internet community. I was doing that, and then I did Prodigy like in 92 or something. I met a bunch of people, great people who I've met and kept in contact with since then. But like I got to go to an ECW. That's how I got to go to my first ECW show up in Philadelphia, was through the guys I had met on RSPW, and a bunch of us got together. And then Paulie actually had embraced the community because Dave Shearer was starting his newsletter through ECW, you know, kind of passing out free copies. It was called the Wrestling Lariat.
Yeah, I actually remember that.
And he was trying to get that up and going through then around 94, I believe, 93, 94. So, yeah, no, I've been kind of an internet presence, but I haven't been a personality necessarily. I've just kind of been around, so to speak.
But yeah, I definitely strongly relate with that. I I had the conversation. Oh God, now our timelines are getting mixed up, and I don't even remember if I talked to you about this already before or someone else. But just that I did, I would like lurk the internet a little bit and like do a little tape trading, even back in the early 90s when, like, just trading VHS tapes with other wrestling fans.
Oh, you did that, really?
Yeah, when I was like middle school. You know,
I did that. I did that in college as well for like FMW hardcore stuff.
Yeah,
like
that's that was essentially it.
You trade wrestling videotapes with other people who also went online, like on a specific. Well,
it was easier for me because I would do something along those lines. But even before that, guys were doing it through the mail, and essentially a lot of the contacts were being started through newsletters. Wow. So like guys would writers or readers pages in the back of the newsletters where people would just kind of post like, hey, I have XYZ interested in this, or there were some magazines that even offered just like pen pals, it was like under the guise that they were just trying to set up pen pals.
Yeah,
but it was realistically people were using it to set up tape trades.
I never knew that about you, Tim. That's really interesting.
Well, it was easier for me, like I said, because by the time I was doing it, the internet existed. So my tape trading was email, and so, you know, and that's how it was set up. I didn't have to do all that work to try to get a hold of these people.
Right. And for us and within my community, it was because ECW and Smoky Mountain were so sporadic in terms of syndication at times that you'd be missing like months because they'd preempt it or they just wouldn't show it, and you'd be like, "Hey, what happened here? We wanted to see this." So. If you had two VCRs, you could make copies, and
exactly.
Or if you're just done with a tape, you could send it off to the next guy.
That was the thing that took me a while to learn. I was like, wait, I should be making copies of these and not just sending out my originals every time.
That's like the old school way of seeding, basically, is what it sounds like.
Yes.
Essentially, yeah.
That's really
cool. That's exactly what it is.
I find it really interesting, like how people communicated even before the internet. Like that's like a reply all episode idea right there.
It probably should. Actually, it would make sense for them to do an episode about like wrestling tape trading and stuff.
Yeah,
like from the early, like the stuff that Jeff is talking about with the message boards.
Yeah.
And I was going to mention that too. Like Bill Simmons, was running the AOL wrestling forum originally, right?
Hey,
before
Bill
he
Simmons?
Got it. Yeah.
No. It wasn't Simmons. I don't think.
I know Simmons. He was involved in some board.
Yeah, I think he had his own board. One of the big guys for wrestling for Smarts was Dave Lagana.
Yeah, yeah.
Back in the day. And that's how I kind of knew him before I moved to L.A. But not that I know him, but we've met a couple times. But, yeah, no, I know Bill Simmons was active in there because he only would have been like – he would have been in his early 20s then. I don't think he was running things, but he was. I think he could have been involved. I don't remember a lot. I wasn't involved in AOL. I was involved with Prodigy, so I wouldn't know AOL.
Yeah, I think he was involved with the AOL when it switched, and there was the official like AOL boards, and there stuff was actually endorsed by AOL and sponsored and about pro wrestling. I think he was involved in that.
Okay.
If I remember correctly, that's the way I heard it. But I don't, you know, I might be off. Like you, I think I lurked a lot. And that's what I was getting into is a lot of my wrestling community where I sat and talked about wrestling was with real people in real life. I was just lucky in that regard. But over the past few years, I've like gotten more involved in the actual online forums. And you're right, like trying to just do like, oh, I'm going to do my boarding on PWO while I'm at work is really tough because a lot of it's like super in-depth thought out posts and you're having like big long thoughts and it's kind of like sneaking that in between coffee breaks and stuff like that just doesn't work to try to write out this big long thought involved post. But that's why PWO is really great because a lot of people are committed to it and they put a lot into the conversation. They're not just, you know, random people throwing out like nasty comments about Becky Lynch's hair or something, you know?
Yeah, well, that's interesting that of your evolution, because for me, when I got to college, that was how I maintained contact with professional wrestling, because by the time I had graduated from high school, most of my friends had stopped watching wrestling. I came from a really big hotbed. I grew up in southeastern Virginia, which is Crockett Country. And so, like,
what does that mean exactly? Crockett Country.
Jim Crockett Promotions, which was the late 80s NWA, the Ric Flair, the Horsemen, Dusty Rhodes, all those guys. And you'd get shows like every other week in two different cities in the area where I was from, southeastern Virginia. And then you'd have certain syndicated shows from other territories. This is at the end of the territory era. where, you know, not even the World Wrestling Federation, wouldn't even come south of Washington, D.C. back then.
Wow.
Because they couldn't sell any shows. That didn't start until around the early 90s, I would say, when they finally started coming down regularly into like Virginia, North Carolina, et cetera, et cetera. So that's how, I mean, by the time I got to college and I didn't have cable in college at first and things like that, that's how I kind of maintained my fandom, was through the internet, so to speak.
Interesting.
Okay. So you kind of like kept it going by joining up with the internet and all this. And so you said you started out in Virginia, which I guess shouldn't be shocking. But I never really thought that's a weird thing about you, Jeff, is number one, I know you're a little bit older than yes. I am, at least. Yes. And I know that, you know, you're from Virginia, but you live here in Southern California in Los Angeles. And I mean, you host a show with Rob McCarron, who's a little bit younger. He's probably closer to my age. And yes. You never, to me, you come across like you're kind of like that nondescript all-American. Like, I don't think of you as being from a region, and I don't think of you as being older than me. Like, honestly, like, your personality, the way you come across. Every now and then you talk about just how much you do prefer or only preferred the Crockett tag team, all that stuff. But other than that, I never think like, oh, Jeff is like noticeably older than me. You know what I mean? You come across just like normal dude, like, if that makes any sense. Like, I don't think Jeff is from this place and Jeff is, you know, this old and all that. Like, you stay on the pulse and you just kind of are just come across like essentially you could be any age and from anywhere.
I still enjoy wrestling for the most part. So I think that also helps. I'm not necessarily watching it because I feel like I have a duty to watch it. Like, I know some people do, or like, it's like, I'm going to watch with my arms crossed and you have to do something for me. I think it's the generational thing that also helps shake them ropes quite a bit, especially going through this top 100 matches to see before you die, which the WWE.com put out there that are on the network, because I have more of a historical background for the 80s stuff, and Rob really has more for, say, the early aughts and up to now, where my fandom kind of lapsed a bit, to be honest, because it was just like once WWE got a monopoly, I really was like, well, it's okay, but it's not must see watching for me.
Right. Anymore. No, I agree with you somewhat in that regard, but I'm also kind of, my roots come from the South and from the Pacific Northwest.
Okay.
So like my grandmother on my mother's side is from the South. She showed me NWA, Crockett, stuff like that when I was a little kid. And then my dad's side of the family is from up north, Washington, some people who moved all the way up into Portland, stuff like that. And so I saw a lot of that stuff. Plus I grew up here in Southern California, so I'd watch stuff from LA, Lucha Libre, all this and that. So realistically, WWE was never important to me.
Okay.
So when they became the big number one company, I always kind of like, oh, I'm going to keep watching stuff from Japan. And then, you know, the indie explosion, and a lot of it is getting very regionally. Like, you can tell which companies are from which parts of America now. When it used to, in the beginning of the super indie thing, it was kind of like these shows could be going on anywhere. Well, now you're starting to see certain guys who are becoming stars in certain regions. Other guys are going everywhere. Then there's, you know, the internet, you're able to have access to everything. And through all that, I'm still never been a huge WWE fan. So
right.
It's kind of like the main wrestling that I know. It's primarily all you watch. I mean, I know you watch other stuff as well, but primarily it seems you watch mostly WWE product, right? That's what Shake Them Ropes is about.
We are a WWE-centric show for the most part, but we're allowed to – what we do is, you know, because both Rob and I are interested in other feds and like Lucha Underground or PWG or New Japan or Ring of Honor. If there's a World Wrestling Entertainment through line that we could – angle that we can put into that – somehow, then we can go on into that. We don't dwell on it, but we will talk about it. But mostly what we were brought on to Voices of Wrestling to do mostly is to basically give kind of the mainstream product for the Voices network, so to speak.
Right.
Whereas Voices are much more in depth with, like, say, the Dragon Gates of the world and things that I don't have the time to watch, to be honest with you. So, yeah, our wheelhouse is mostly WWE. And then for my personal viewing, I like going back. And right now I'm trying to watch stuff from my youth that I didn't ever have a chance to watch from other federations.
Okay. Yeah, like stuff that was at the time, but you didn't even watch at the time
when
you.
Well, yeah, like I had never had access to Memphis in the late 80s before.
Okay.
And I'm currently on binging on that.
What are you thinking of the Memphis? Because it seems a lot of people get really into it. I'm not one of them. I never got into it. And then it seems like other people just kind of can't stand it. Where are you at right now?
It's hit and miss for me. I think there's a lot of good, especially when it's heated. It's really, really good. Like when you have that real fight intensity of it, but there's just some hokey stuff in Memphis in terms of gimmicks. And there's a lot of sports entertainment, as I like to say, to it as well.
Oh yeah, definitely. No, that's true. But
as opposed to say your Mid-South of the same kind where it was just all athleticism and all kind of, you know, I remember I watched an episode from, I think, 84, 83 that was all about getting over the figure four leg lock as a maneuver. And you're just like, well, this is different than what I see here and here and here.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, there's a huge difference. And it's funny, the Mid-South and Memphis parallels that you draw is still to this day.
Yeah.
It's like there is the Evolve versus whatever Brit Rest or Dragon Gate. You know, it's kind of stays that way forever, that there's the people who like the essentially more dry athletic based stuff. And there's the people who like the more kind of storyline heavy. And I don't know, I think I come down liking the drier stuff more often, but I also can appreciate the storyline stuff. So it's really interesting.
It's weird. I'm a new convert to Evolve. I've only really been watching a few months now. I went and saw my first Evolve shows over WrestleMania weekend, and I really liked what I saw. And then I've been buying I bought 60 and 61, and I've been really enjoying that. I think both styles work. I just think for me at its base, professional wrestling is a theatrical art form based on talking smack and fake fighting. Now, whether you want to get there through pure athleticism or you want to get there through storylines is fine, but you have to remember what brings people into the dance to watch it. It's neither of those, really. It's we're going to be watching a fight, and we're going to be suspending our disbelief that this is a fight.
Right. I think I'd love to really dig deep into this conversation, but that's not what the point of this show is supposed to be.
Okay, I didn't know what the point of the show
was. No, we're free form. I'm still figuring that out. Yeah, we're just doing this is about getting to know Jeff, right? Because especially on Shake Them Ropes, you guys seem to have a format. You guys follow it really well. You hit your spots. You do your thing. And that's a good show.
It's Rob looking at the clock and going, let's get this moving. I want this under an hour. That's all it is.
No, but I mean, that's why that's a good show for what it is. But this show is, you know, inside the actor's studio, or this is the background, because I'm a fan of your podcast and I'm a fan of all these other podcasts and all these other people who maybe just write articles and all these different things. And I'm like, but who is that guy? You know, that's what I think about. Cause all you do is you produce your product. That's your job. And I enjoy your product, and you shouldn't maybe editorialize or kind of like do gonzo journalism on your show as much. So this is the chance for the people who never get to know you to find out who you are. But
and what's your weird, favorite?
It's weird. Oh, fucktard is my favorite. I absolutely love that. no, it's weird because I end up dropping in hints about my life on the show to the point where I feel like I've always revealed a bit too much. But no, I'm happy to talk about how I got here if you want to talk about that. I'm good with that.
I'm going to get into that right now. You got me thinking about that, about it's a fake fight. And I think I saw some conversation this morning on Twitter about that, as we're recording this, the hot issue is Ricochet versus Ospreay, right?
Right.
People won't stop talking about it. And then they're talking about it's supposed to be a fake fight and this and that. But when people say, could you do that in a real fight? Or that's not what a fight looks like. People also have to stop and remember that this is a professional wrestling match. So it would be like saying, well, if someone's running and jumping hurdles in an Olympic event, that's not the way I would run away from the cops.
You know what I mean? I don't think you can be beholden to it has to be a straight fight necessarily. Right. You know, there are elements of that. And I do think professional wrestling as a art form, to be honest with you, it's changed since WWE took over everything into being, and with the boom of the indies, when the indies died in the mid-90s, so to speak, and then they started coming back in the early 2000s. Not that they weren't around before, but in terms of the boom period of it being a sweet spot, they were a different thing than what I knew. So and I'm willing to concede that it's more of a choreographed exhibition for that. My only issue and my concern with current professional wrestling is I do think the art of selling has been lost quite a bit. I think selling is far more important than we give it credit for. And what's been happening on the indies in terms of indie matches that I watch now is that you have all these athletic flips and dives and things of that nature that don't take their toll on the guys in the ring in terms of the story of the match. And so you increase the amount of flips and dives and hard hitting moves towards the end to make up for that in pace. And I think specifically of, say, like on Evolve 60, I think it was 61. It was either 60 or 61. The Hero Zack Sabre Jr. match, where you're literally kicking a guy in the face as hard as you can, and it's doing nothing until towards the end, where you just keep on kicking, 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 and finally get through it. You have to do more of that to get less damage, so to speak. And that's, to me, a bit of a weird trend that I'm not full on Jim Cornette yelling at a cloud, but right. it is a criticism I have of current product.
Yeah, no, I mean, I constantly agree with that about the selling. I think people get confused and they don't realize that basically all of wrestling is selling, and it's when you're selling in a match, you're not just selling moves, you're actually selling tickets. Like, that's how you have to think about it. And
well, and you're also selling emotion. You're selling the emotion of the match, and if you're not selling properly, you're not getting the crowd involved in wanting to see you come back necessarily.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, like I said, this is a conversation where we could right. go forever. And yeah. and you mentioned you guys, your show, Shake Them Ropes, being kind of the counter to the Voices of Wrestling kind of main podcast on the network. Now, I don't know that your podcast started out on the Voices of Wrestling network, but I was thinking about it. And I know that you and Rob have some background with the F4W kind of forums and kind of how the podcast got started. I've heard you guys talk about that was through the F4W forums. And I think it's interesting that in a way, over at, you know, Figure Four, I guess I'll say, if people don't know what F4W is, obviously it's The Observer, it's Brian Alvarez, Figure Four. When that network started out their alternative programming, which was the Adam and Mike Big Audio Nightmare.
Right.
It was about the opposite. It was like the main show was talking nothing but WWE. Brian would, you know, kind of mix in a little bit of ROH and maybe some of the stuff that him and his trainer, Buddy Wayne, were doing up in the Pacific Northwest areas. But mostly it was mainstream WWE, TNA. That's what they talked about. So they said, let's bring in some guys to do Japan. And it's just so funny that Voices of Wrestling, it was almost the opposite. It was like they were focused. I know originally they were focused more on where Rich lives yeah. in like Chicago. They were covering a lot of that stuff. And then Joe was talking about stuff from Texas, and then they'd sprinkle in kind of Japanese stuff. And now their focus is mostly on Japanese. But
mm-hmm.
how did Shake Them Ropes start out? Did it start out as part of the Voices of Wrestling family? Am I wrong in thinking that that's not true?
That, no, you're correct in thinking that's not true, because we were our own podcast on our own feed for a while. And Rob was really the one who approached them, I believe, or they approached us. I can't remember which one it was. I didn't get involved in this part. But no, Rob and Rich have a relationship. And we got put onto their feed, and it's been, you know, most helpful for us, I think. How we started was Rob was writing Raw reviews over for the Wrestling Observer at the time, and he's like, hey, I'm thinking about doing a podcast. Would anybody be interested? And I had a blue snowball microphone that I wasn't using. I had originally done it for, say, voiceovers for auditions, or I was thinking about doing podcasts of my own, but not about wrestling, about something else. And so I said, hey, you know what? I'd like to try this out. And you know what? If it goes somewhere, great. If it doesn't, I'd love to just be kind of a rotating panelist or whatever. And his idea was to be kind of a, pardon the interruption, for wrestling. Do like you have like 7 different topics, you know, rapid fire, 5 minutes apiece, something like that, and a couple of different things. What turned out was, well, some topics are more important than others, and we need ample time to go through them. So that whole being timed for each segment thing just didn't go over well at all. But I did one audition, or we recorded one, and I don't know if he recorded with anybody else, to be honest with you. I hadn't heard of anybody at the time, but it seemed to go well. And so we started putting it out on our own, and then about, I think, 8 or 10 episodes in, we became part of Voices of Wrestling.
Okay. Now that's kind of similar to how I got started with This Week in Wrestling. It was like, oh, come in, try it out, we'll see how it goes. And then after being on once, it was like, oh, okay, so next week we're doing this. And then it just keeps happening where it's like, next week we're doing this and next week we're doing that. So that seems to be the way it is. It's like once you find that fit, you just kind of want to stick with it because it feels right. And I think, like we've already mentioned multiple times here, you and Rob are a good fit together, obviously, bringing multiple generations, multiple different ways of looking at it. I find it funny. I think Rob sometimes comes across like he's trying to brighten you up, but with my personal interactions with you, I find that you're not you're actually a more cheery guy than I think you come across on the show.
I don't like the WWE all that much, and that's a weird place to be for a person who talks about WWE. I am not a homegrown WWE guy. I approach it with a certain amount of skepticism for a number of reasons. One of which is I've had friends who worked for the company. I myself was up for a job with creative and didn't get it at some point. So it's like you kind of see the flaws in there. My point of the show and what I tried to do originally, I originally wanted to be Jordan Breen from Sure Dog, the MMA podcasting guys. I wanted to be kind of that intelligent guy with the historical perspective and the cool voice and all that. I just couldn't get to that point. So what I started doing was analyzing it from the perspective of I've done some screenwriting and I both teach and perform improv. So from a performance aspect of it. So I was trying to take those two parts and apply it to the gimmick that they say of being the longest running scripted television show in history. Okay, if you are a scripted television show, then what are you doing that other TV shows are doing properly that you should be doing? That was my angle on the whole thing when I did that. In addition to, here's the stuff from professional wrestling that I grew up with in the territory days that turned me off of WWE when I first saw it, and I just thought it was just Technicolor kiddie crap. And what could they do to give it more of the edge that they're looking for that they always want, but they always kind of they shirk at it, to be honest with you. They don't want to be Southern wrestling, so to speak. So those were the angles I was starting to take, and I still kind of take those at the time, just knowing. And part being, you know, going back to our first conversation, the IWC, I learned so much from guys on there. You know, there was at least one guy who cribbed most of the notes from the Observer week after week to tell us everything. I mean, you learn so much about what's going on behind the scenes. You learn how people treat each other. You learn about the office politics that you can see some of the machinations on screen once you know all this stuff. So it all filters in through. And yeah, Rob's a little bit more cheery in that respect. I'm kind of more the critical voice on Shake Them Ropes.
Yeah, it's very interesting too, taking the kind of the insider knowledge that you have, having worked on some regular, like not regular, but some more mainstream productions of television shows and stuff like that, and knowing people who work in them, and then, like you said, knowing the background of WWE itself, and then kind of going like, well, if you're going to set this standard for yourself, referring to it as a scripted television show, then let's, you know, critique you that way. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about it like it is a television show, which I think I was actually having this conversation just yesterday with a friend of mine, that pro wrestling criticism seems to be just light years behind kind of critical viewing and reviewing of any other form of media. And it always comes down to that same argument about, like, you don't get it because you're not in it. And it's like, they don't use that. They don't use that metric for any other form of review or critique. They don't say that for literally any other kind of performance. And I tweeted out making the reference to it, like, we don't let cows tell us which milk is good. Just because you wrestle doesn't mean you know what the best kind of wrestling looks like compared to anybody else. And I know that's kind of bad, like comparing wrestlers to livestock, but if you think about it from movie, it's like, when do they tell, like, Siskel and Ebert, like, you guys never made a movie, so you don't know what you're talking about. Well, when it comes to reviewing movies.
At its heart, it's a very thin-skinned and defensive industry because it's based on carny stuff of it being a total ripoff for other people.
Right.
So, and it was weird because, going to your point, within 2 weeks, of each other. Actually, it would be four because his show is biweekly. Lance Storm opined, "Well, I'm on tele. It was during. So he goes, I don't understand why I don't get the respect I should from other television actors and other TV people because I'm also in the television and entertainment industry." And then 2 weeks later, people who were critical of it, "Well, you don't know because you're not in it and you don't understand." It wants to have it both ways in many, many respects.
Well, it seems
in terms of it wants to be respected as an art form, but if you choose to pipe up on your opinion doesn't matter. And that in turn goes to why people don't necessarily want to be involved and talk up your industry as well. It's all kind of the same circular argument.
Right. It seems mostly it's kind of the WWE's kind of machinations that they are kind of an actual scripted television show. It doesn't seem like a lot of other wrestling companies have ever kind of tried to make that argument. But then it seems that people, like you said, like Lance, who have worked in the WWE, then turn around and kind of do that, like, "I'm in the entertainment industry. Why don't I get treated as such?"
And they're a little bit different because Vince always wanted to be a media mogul. Everything right. You want to know about Vince McMahon, you can watch the documentary, the Jake the Snake, New Jack, Cactus Jack documentary. Beyond the Mat. Everything you need to know about Vince McMahon and his opinion of wrestling is on that thing. He wants to be Cecil B. DeMille. He wants to run a movie studio, and wrestling is his conduit.
Yeah, exactly. So let's get into kind of your entertainment background. And You said you started out in Virginia. So what brings you out to Los Angeles? I know you kind of have a big boy job. You're an actual professional out here. I don't know if you traveled to Los Angeles for that or if it was more to kind of aspiring towards your entertainment dreams or working in the entertainment industry. So what gets you to LA and what's your background in the entertainment fields?
I started doing stand-up comedy when I was 17 years old in Virginia. And it was actually for an English project, and it was like the last week, and I was one of those people who was – I wasn't the class clown. I was the class wit, so to speak, but I had always had a fascination with comedy and just watching like all sorts of when I was like 9, I was watching Marx Brothers marathons and just fascinated by it. And it's stand up, and any chance I could watch a stand up special like A&E Night at the Improv or things like that, I was just engrossing myself in comedy, and I loved it so much. So I started doing stand up like open mics around 17, and working clubs around the Virginia, North Carolina, DC area. Got to see guys like Dave Chappelle in their early days because he and I are the same age. Patton Oswalt actually used to run one of the open mics in my area. This was after he had graduated college, and he'd come to Southeastern Virginia like once a week to run this shitty open mic in my hometown, which was kind of cool. And then when I got into college, I started writing more jokes. I was part of something called the Virginia Pep Band, which we were a lot like Stanford's band, if you're familiar with them at all. Basically a bunch of smart, too smart for their own good kids who would get drunk and do football halftime shows and make body jokes in front of 30,000 people or so.
Okay.
And that's how I started actually writing. But I was still doing stand up. I tried to get Whose Line Is It Anyways was big. The British version was big when I was like getting first into college, and I tried to start a group there, and that's only kind of – and I love telling this story because the only other person who was interested in such a thing was Tina Fey, who was a senior when I was a freshman at my college. But I was doing stand-up gigs. Skipping class is quite a bit. Unfortunately, I didn't go to these gigs, and eventually that turned into going to wrestling shows and skipping classes. But but the day after I graduated from UVA, I had to start class at NYU doing script writing. So I took a summer program at NYU, learning how to do sitcom writing, and I got I made connections through my UVA Alumni Association with someone who was working on a television show out here in LA. And I had a decision to make because she seemed rather amicable to, you know, reading my stuff and maybe hire me on as a writer's assistant. But you have to be in LA to do it. Okay, great. So I was trying to decide whether I was going to go to Chicago to study at Second City or to go out to LA and pursue this. So I went out to LA, and on my way there, the producer who I had an in with had gotten fired from Grace Under Fire, which was the show that I was going to – it's a mid-90s show starring
– I remember that show.
Brett Butler. And I got to go in for one day, I think, and then after that everybody's staff had cleaned out their desks and whatnot. She'd had a mass firing because she was having her own personal substance abuse issues and whatnot. And I eventually went from there to working for doing a little bit of PA work for a director by the name of Tom Shadiak, who did Liar Liar and The Nutty Professor and things of that nature. And that lasted a little bit. But I was doing, you know, stand-up at the same time, doing the open mic circuit out in L.A. and doing that. And eventually I bounced from a couple Comedy Central shows that only lasted a season for the most part. And then reality TV came in and kind of wiped out a lot of jobs. So I decided I needed to pay my bills more than anything. So that's when I started going into my quote unquote big boy job. I decided to stay in LA instead. And I really wasn't enamored with doing stand up anymore because for me, I got sick of doing the same 7 to 10 minutes every night in the club. I got bored with it. And you're doing it in open mics are tough in LA, especially because it's the same people doing the same material night after night after night. You don't do it in front of clubs necessarily. You do these sets in front of bookers or people who run nights so that they put you on and then you can do it in front of those people. And there was a point where I'm getting ready to go up and do a set in front of a paid crowd. And they do something out in LA called bringer shows, which I think you're probably familiar with, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. I had brought three people, which was a miracle for me because I had basically run through all my friends. and the guy, as they're introducing me to go up on the stage, I get a whisper, yeah, we thought you were going to bring four, but you only brought three. So we're going to cut your set by 2 minutes.
Jeez.
And I went, look, my friends have sat through all your deadbeat fucking friends. You know, basically what these guys do is they run rooms and they book all their friends as comics so that all the people you bring can come watch them and tell them how brilliant they are. And then you get to go on later. And by that time, all your friends are exhausted because there's like 20 comics on the bill. And it's just, a lot of that is a grind. So I just said, screw it. So I got into improv, which I really, really liked. And I've been involved with that for a good 16 years. And I've traveled across the country doing improv and kind of subsisting me and my partner's improv stuff with my big boy job, but also by teaching workshops and things like that. So I've been very happy doing that. Within that, I've met a lot of people who do wrestling, who are wrestlers, who have written for wrestling. I used to do a show with Chris Roach, who is now the executive producer of Lucha Underground, and he was on the creative team for WWE for a very short time, and his story kind of became infamous on Lagana's old podcast as being the guy who said, "No, I don't really want to do this full time," and leaving, and being happy about leaving.
Yeah,
So I mean, that's how I got there. I submitted at the same time because I had caught wind they were looking for writers at the same time as Chris, and he got the job, and I didn't. But I was more than happy for him. '92, I had actually tried to train a little bit at Smoky Mountain. I didn't have the cardio for it. And that was when they were trying to run people out. So you basically gave them the $250 to call me a weak ass bitch and let me leave after a day.
Yeah. So the wrestling training business is so weird. Just the different entities of how it's worked. If it's always been, there's always been that risk of getting ripped off, but,
that's
interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that one of your friends was a writer for wrestling. I'm just curious because Tim and I have actually talked about this in the past. What's the process like for doing that? Do you know much about it, or how does that work?
Yeah. Well, like when I mean, he got his job based with Lucha by after he left WWE, he went to reality television, and he was working for Big Brother, and that's how Krista Joseph also got hired at Big Brother, and then Mark Burnett is the producer there, and he's also the producer of Lucha Underground, so they just kind of poured it over that way. For me, my process was they asked me, we had to submit a packet or a script or a treatment or however it was, and the requirement for me was to use was to run an angle with at least two already known WWE talents. And to write out a complete storyline with two completely new characters, if you will. And and it was it actually fit into my wheelhouse because back in 92 on Prodigy, I had started doing fantasy wrestling and writing out promos and angles and starting to get into that world. And I had a lot of fun doing that for about five or six years doing that. So I had no problem creating actual characters. And I had no real problem doing a story. And apparently I got some good feedback on it, but they decided to pass on me at the time, mostly because it was one of those times when and you're told this by other people. I've known more than one person who's worked there. They go, you don't really know if they want to hire wrestling fans or want to hire people who know nothing about wrestling. So you have to make the call whether or not you're going to fake not knowing anything in order to get the job, or just tell them the truth and hope for the best.
Yeah.
And I told them the truth and hope for the best, but at the same time, in doing so, it was kind of like, okay, here's what I'm interested in. You guys don't really do any of that.
Right.
But certain people like P.S. Hayes loved that. I had an interest in tag teams, apparently, but at the same time, they weren't pushing tag teams at the time because Vince doesn't find tag teams marketable, or he used to not. It used to be tag teams used to be a means to an end to find one star to push. So that's how I came. But that was a few years ago. I don't know how they do it now, or especially with this brand split coming up, because they're always hiring. But it's a weird thing in that they're not a union shop, so it's hard for them to get quote-unquote quality TV writers. So they get guys who were writer's assistants or who have a credit or two here or there, or people willing to scab. Like one of the head writers was an alumni from UVA who was a year ahead of me. And I wrote to him. He's a former soap opera writer who went on to work for the Arsenio Hall show, and he filled me in on some things. So.
Wow. That's really interesting to hear. It doesn't sound too dissimilar from just how you would do it for a regular TV show. So that's kind
no,
of what
it's
I
not.
Wanted to know when we talked about it last time. It's just like, how different is it from a regular scripted series, you know?
Okay, I'll tell you that then. In regular scripted television, you never write a treatment for the show that you want
to
work for.
Right, right. You have to use because those, spec, right?
Right, because those shows know the characters, and if you do that – now that's changed a bit over the years because there were some shows that would accept that. But for the most part, you're just trying to show them that you know story structure, you know characters, and you know jokes. Like in sitcoms, you basically have three beats. You have the prologue, you have the quote-unquote dark moment, and you have the resolution. And they just want to know that you can get to that dark moment in the second beat. Right. And move on. But like when you're trying to get an agent and things like that, like for me, when I had one, I had a couple of treatments for scripts. I think the hot spec back then was Friends, but everybody had a Friends by then. I had done News Radio and
love that show.
And The Naked Truth, which had just come on ABC at that time, which I loved until they ported it over to NBC. Yeah. I had some sketches that I had done, and I was really – what I really wanted to, because when I was in New York, my career center came to me and said, Dave Letterman is looking for writers. I was really good at monologue jokes and current events humor. Mm-hmm. And so I submitted a packet to Letterman, and I got an interview there. And that's what I wanted to do out in LA was write for The Tonight Show, really. So that's what I was angling to do. And I got to submit jokes through their fax number, and they bought a couple at, like, I think $25 or $50 a piece. But nothing came of a highly paid staff position. But for the most part, what you're doing – when showrunners want to read your script and they go to the agents, they look for a show that's like theirs but isn't theirs, because the problem is, of course, if you make a character choice that's not within what they know, and they know so much more, then they're going to be inevitably turned off by that.
Yeah. They want to see that you can write for someone else's voice, essentially, is also yes. a part of it.
Yes, that's a big part of it. There's also a big part. In sitcom parlance, there's always one character on there where everything they say is going to be a laugh line. Yeah. They want to make sure that you get that. Again, the dark moment is big, and then the resolution, wrapping up the A and B storylines, is big with them. They just want to know that you can get that structure, that you can write funny, because the thing is, they have punch-up guys to do jokes right. in the room. You know, three or four comic friends of theirs who probably been around the stand-up gig for a long time, who are just punch-up guys, because once you write a script, this was the big thing for me, especially where I – at NYU, because the guy I learned from used to write for a show called Herman's Head, mm-hmm. Which was a great show.
And if you've actually never seen it, I've heard a lot about it being really good, though.
The modern day equivalent of Herman's Head was the movie Inside Out.
Okay.
If you saw that, it was basically it was an office sitcom, but it would do cutscenes into his brain, which had, you know, your happiness, your sadness, your anger, and your id, so to speak, all trying to control different parts of it. But what you get on paper, what you submit as a writer with your name on it, from that to the point where it gets shot, the shooting script, is so vastly different, and your name stays on it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
They don't take off your name. You still get credit for the script and the story and whatnot, but so much of your script can change from that to there. And the difference between that and WWE is, of course, the showrunner is the script writer. Most of the writers at WWE are there trying to give Vince ideas for Vince's sake. You don't get credit as a writer for WWE in terms of great angles or stories that you come up with. They're all supposed to be great stories and angles for Vince to then take credit for.
Right, right, essentially. Wow. You're just working as like his writing assistant.
And that's my life from birth to now.
Yeah, right.
That's really interesting. I didn't realize that you did a lot of stuff comedy related, stand up, writing, improv, all that yeah. good stuff.
Yeah.
So that's cool.
I still love improv though, because it gives me the chance to surprise myself. But I've been kind of there's the unexpected of it all, and yeah. something will happen on stage, and you'll have to deal with it. Stand up, I've started to kind of fall in love with it again, just because I've now gotten comfortable with not being judged by an audience so much through improv, and I can kind of tweak my jokes to interest me as opposed to getting bored. I literally got bored telling a joke on stage. I'm just like, this joke again.
It's funny because I know Tim and myself we're not huge improv people, right, Tim? And we went to a show one time in the desert, and we were like, what the hell is this?
I can understand. Well, poorly done improv is one of the worst experiences that was live done, to sit through.
With the show
that I mean, if it's a little bit more acting related as opposed to trying to go for the funny related, it's far more interesting. Like if you watch, say, Keegan-Michael Key, is one of the most phenomenal improvisers you'll ever watch on stage. I mean, it's those guys that make it big, the guys who are doing interesting and have acting chops, as opposed to what happens a lot of times is stand-ups go into improv and they end up wanting to be the quick-witted, wacky, funny guy, and that doesn't serve improv all that well. All the instincts for stand-up are the opposite of what you do for improv. Good improv, for the most part. So I understand when people go, I saw improv, it's not really my thing. I go, yeah, I get that. Trust me. But it's a vast chasm of, you know, it's like the difference between watching an open mic stand-up and watching a really professional 60-minute set or so.
Right.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Do you remember that show, Tim, that we went to in the desert?
I do. I completely remember it. And
where was it? Like Indio?
No, yeah, it was Palm Springs.
Palm Springs? Okay.
Yeah. And it was – well, this is the thing. And the reason why kind of I've always thought it didn't work for me, especially in those settings. And like you said, I've never even really thought of the serious aspect of it, people doing more serious stand-up. But a lot of times all I would see was it was people who – wanted to do acting, and all of their friends always told them that they were the funny one of the group. Yeah. And yeah, they're just trying to be the funny one of the group. And it's four or five, I'm the funny one of the group on stage trying to be the funniest. And a lot of times it's like, as you said, as you mentioned, and I don't know if you said it today or if it was in a personal conversation that we were having, but a lot of the stand-up open mics turns into like kind of gunslingers gunfighting, and yes, everyone's up there just doing their 5 to 7 minutes trying to get booked on everyone else's shows. It's like somehow this really roided up version of that where it's like almost a reality show. Let's get all of these people who think they're funny on stage at the same time, literally do it, trying to do their 7 minutes of funny material all on top of each other. You know, yeah, and that's it gets really annoying.
The thing about improv is it's very easy access to get stage time because you don't need a lot of props or mics or anything like that. And you don't need a lot of training necessarily to go up there and do it poorly. And so what you get is a lot of people out, especially here in LA, where it's, well, I wanted to come out to LA to do something very creative. Oh, here's improv. And it has a very, for lack of a better term, a very cult mentality to it, because you have lots of groups. Once you're in a classroom, you have instant 14 other friends who are going through the same thing as you are, plus people from other classes. And so you have that kind of safe space there, but you're really trying to, it's learning on the job and in front of people, you know, your technique and your craft. It's like going up trying to do Shakespeare without learning blocking.
For the most part,
as opposed to doing that in the classroom and learning it before you invite all your friends, because every person within the first year of improv has already invited all their friends to their fucking show, and then they've just burned them out of improv, where it's kind of like being a stand-up and inviting people to your first showcase. And by the time you get actually good and you say, hey, come out and see me, they go, well, we've seen your stuff already. We don't really need to see
it. I'd rather get invited to an MLM scheme than an improv scheme.
Oh, really?
No, I'm not kidding.
Well, there's a lot in common with improv theaters and MLM.
Yeah,
so
there is, isn't there?
Hey, you didn't make this level just yet. Maybe if you pay half to take this again, you'll make it next time. Yeah.
I don't know if you guys watch Broad City, but there's an episode where one of the characters stops dating this dude who's like really hot, attractive, because she sees his improv show and how terrible he is.
Oh yeah, well they're actually from UCB. They're from the Amy Poehler
School of Improv Comedy
branch of the UCB comedy tree, so to speak.
Funny that of all the things that turn her off, it's just how bad he is at improv.
Any show that is trashing improv either has improvisers on staff that know it, or they have people like Family Guy. Oh, I had a friend who was writer's assistant or production assistant there, and she made the mistake of telling the writers that she did improv.
Oh, no.
And it became 40 minutes of trashing improv in the writer's room that eventually, I think, made it to one of the episodes at least. And it was just like, oh Brandy, don't ever tell them that again.
Jesus. Wow. Well, Jeff, I mean, you said you go around with your partner. I think – do you have – multiple different acts that you work with, or at least two, right?
I have two that I do, one not so much anymore. The main one I do is one called Billy Hawk. And you know, it's a lot of fun. We try and blend a little bit of drama, a little bit of comedy in there, and we don't have anything terribly scheduled because right now we're helping to launch a theater out here in LA, which is financial death for most people, but it's really grown a lot. It's called the Pack Theater.
I actually heard about it.
Yeah, and our guru and our coach and the other guy I play with is the guy who's in charge of that. His name's Miles Stroth, who in improv history or lore is a big deal, but maybe not so much to you. Do you watch Life in Pieces at all?
I do not.
On CBS? Okay. Well, his claim to fame is he had a two-person show with a guy on that show by the name of Dan Backdahl, who was also on Jim Jefferies' show on FX.
That
called
sounds familiar. Dan Backdahl?
Yeah. Dan Backdahl's been in a lot. He was in
I probably watched that Jim Jefferies
legit
show.
Legit on FX. He was a big part of that.
I know who you're talking about.
He was in – he's a bald guy.
Yeah, he looks kind of like the guy who does the bugle with what's his name? John Oliver.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's Dan Backdahl. They used to have a two-person show in Chicago that was really, really a big deal. And he was Dan's teacher. So Miles is good people, and he ascribes to what we like to call as something being wonderfully horrible.
Like, okay.
And how he puts it is he remembers that his first class, the guy that's the guru of long form improv, a guy by the name of Del Close. If you ever saw Ferris Bueller's Day Off or The Untouchables, he has a bit part in that. But this waitress comes down in the middle of class and just passes by, and Del just looks at her and goes, "Well, she's pretty enough to kill." and Miles goes, "I'm in. Whatever it is, I'm in." You know, it's the study of comedy for this school of thought is you never solve problems, you make them worse, and by making them worse, they become funny. So
I actually am quite interested in that idea, like that concept of kind of humor, because that's in some ways it's what I like. I already am interested in. I like making jokes that kind of go that way, where you just go take things from bad to worse. You know, I love that.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the Albert Brooks school of comedy, where you're just kind of almost a helpless victim while things fall apart around you.
Yeah, right.
What was that show with David Cross where he goes to the UK to sell energy drinks or something?
Oh, Todd Margaret.
That show's like a prime example of that concept where everything just gets worse and worse and worse.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing ever good happens for him on
that show. Yeah, but he's to blame in that. And I don't know, Jeff, you're saying more or less like they're a victim of circumstance.
That's Albert Brooks, like that part of it. But in the improv we do, we are sometimes the proponents of bad decisions,
right?
In terms of that and making those things worse. That's a big part of British comedy, and that's why I love like the original Office.
Oh,
it's so good.
Office. Yeah,
it's so good. Oh, I'll give you another great lambasting of improv is watch the Ricky Gervais show. The one with Warwick Davis.
Life is too short or something like that.
Yeah. Where Liam Neeson comes in.
Oh.
And they decide let's do some improv.
Oh,
and all, yeah, and all Liam Neeson can do is say, "I have full blown AIDS." That's all. I
saw that.
Let's do some improvisational comedy. But Liam, let's do some improvisational comedy. He just strong arms them. I love that he just strong arms them into doing improvisational comedy.
Yes.
So great. It's my favorite
meta scene about the comedy that we do.
That's so perfect. All right, Jeff. Well, I think at this point we're just talking about TV shows and stuff that we like. So
if there's any other questions you want to hit me, I'll answer anything about me that you want to know.
That's what we do for the closing. So I offer it up to Adrian, but he already got in. So Adrian, you got anything?
No, I was actually going to ask you what you're working on now, and you said that you're working on a new like comedy like type of theater or
yeah, show. I'm not as involved as others, but we're just building a small improv theater in LA right now.
Cool.
For me personally, I'm working on getting in shape and doing auditions and stuff around town, because I've actually gotten more into performing over the past few years, and I did a nice stint on a television show called Enlightened. If you ever watched that on HBO, I'd appreciate it. But it only lasted 2 seasons. I was in the second season, mostly as featured background, but I do get a nice shot.
Now, are you credited as Jeff Hawkins in the work?
I'm mostly for my acting. Yes, for my writing, I like to keep that on the down low.
Okay.
No, I was on an episode of A Thousand Ways to Die. If you ever watched that show,
I've seen that show. That's a good show.
Actually, it's funny because a friend of mine wrote me on Facebook. He was just watching late night TV. I guess it's still on in place. He goes, "What the F was this, Hawkins? You never told us you were on this." I'm like, "Yeah, that's the first thing I ever booked."
And you're on IMDb, right? I would assume.
I think I do. I never really have updated it. There's like six Jeff Hawkins on there, and I think one of them's.
I just Googled it. There's a bunch.
Yeah. My writing is not credited as Jeff Hawkins, and a lot of my writing was actually ghostwriting or off the book. So, especially for Comedy Central, because that was non-union stuff. So
that makes sense.
We
I was wondering
talk more sometime outside of the show, because I'd love to bend your ear a little bit about certain things, if you wouldn't mind.
Oh, sure. No, my email box is always open.
Cool.
Well, and that's part of it too, is that once this kind of, there's plenty of wrestling journalists and wrestling personalities to interview, obviously, but once we kind of start getting to the bottom of the barrel, I'm going to go back too and
me.
And dig up. No. I mean, after we've gone through the first runs, I want to start digging up the dirt, and I feel like Jeff Hawkins might be a guy who knows where some of the bodies are buried with such a long time involved in the IWC and stuff like that. So I want to hear about Dave Shearer getting into, you know, text flame wars with whoever on RSPW back in the day. You know, that's what we're gonna
have. That happened. Oh, yeah. Trust me, that then Bob Ryder getting in arguments about ripping off people on One Wrestling and things of that nature. Yeah,
exactly. But otherwise, I think what my closing has been lately is there anything that people who know you only from Shake Them Ropes and I guess really guesting on other podcasts here and there would be surprised to find out about Jeff Hawkins that hasn't already come up at this point? I mean, were you the star athlete of your high school? People don't realize it. Or have you trained a wild cheetahs in the African Sahara at some point? Is there anything along those lines?
I was actually a rising star in Virginia state politics before I got into comedy. And I quit doing that because I got so flustered with the egos being dealt with there. But as they say, never get into a political argument with Hawkins. Just don't, because he's tenacious to the point where you'll hate him even if you like him after arguing politics with him for a while, because he knows so much and he's so well read on certain things.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, I try and keep it to dinner table conversation. I kind of avoid all that because my political life is thankfully over. And I figure that's also how I lost half my jobs in LA, was because they tell you when you have no work experience, put the things you were doing in college on your resume. And, oh, I worked in politics. Well, in LA, there are certain kind of politics that are good and certain kinds of politics that are bad.
Right.
I worked in the certain kind of politics that were bad. So I mean, it's like, oh, I'll give you an example. I was almost a lobbyist for the National Rifle Association, which blows a lot of people's mind. I used to be involved with certain politicians and politics, and my dad teaches hunter safety, so I knew what I was talking about. I'm not an advocate, so to speak, but I had enough ins where I could have gotten a job being a lobbyist in D.C. possibly. Wow. Of course, my other job option coming out of college, straight out of college before I went to grad school, was selling gypsum. So
selling gypsum.
I'm not familiar. What is gypsum?
Sheetrock.
Oh. Okay.
I thought it was some kind of like a thing you find in like those hippy dippy stores, you know, those.
Oh, no. Gypsum is basically
rock or something.
No, it's basically a fancy name for sheetrock.
Okay.
So selling construction materials. I'm like, I didn't go through all this education to go sell sheetrock. So I was a bit of a snob when I was 22.
All right. Well, no, you know what? That's very interesting.
Well, that's actually how I became mod on the board. Asking that is I could handle myself with reasonable decor in terms of not getting too emotional and stuff like that. And also, well, I'm the only one people really hate. So as long as I don't take things personally, then everything's fine. So that's how I got to do that.
Interesting.
That is really interesting, actually.
Well,
don't hate me because I'm what you didn't expect on that front. So
I think it's great that we have people from all different backgrounds and political views.
I don't tweet about that stuff, and I'm not that involved in it anymore, which is very weird. But I still, you know, I mostly in arguments. This is the other thing, is you can never tell what I really believe because I'm usually just playing devil's advocate most of the time.
Yeah.
I'm kind of shaped because I work at a law firm right now. So I shape my arguments like I'm an attorney. So I give these hypothetical questions that just drive people insane. Well, what about this? Well, what about that? It's like, well, I didn't mean it like that, but okay. Let's see you spiral for a while.
Well, I think I do the same thing with the devil's advocate, and actually knowing about the politics would be interesting for us. I would love to have conversations with you because I'm into that. But we were doing the episode with Dylan Hales, and I was doing the devil's advocate with him against anarchism to the point where I think I was trying to make the point that without the police, then, you know, everyone would just like rob everyone, that there's no inherent like moral justification behind people's day-to-day lives without knowing that there's possible punishment. And then that was the moment where I went like, I'm making myself feel gross playing devil's advocate. We have to stop because I went too far.
And I'll do that a lot of times too. It's like, okay, I've gone too far because I'm watching threads spiral into like 25 page missives about things that was never the intent, guys. I was just trying to poke holes in your argument.
Well, Jeff, we'll go ahead and plug, I guess, whatever you have. Shake Them Ropes. I mean, that's the weird thing about plugging at the end of the show is that we've already spent the whole time talking about everything.
Well, okay. Here's where you can find me. If you'd like to talk to me on Twitter, I am at CrapGame13. Why Crap Game? Crap Game is the name of the Don Rickles character from Kelly's Heroes. I was a big fan of Don Rickles. I still am, and 13 is my lucky number, and nobody else would ever take that moniker.
Is
so,
he still alive, see, Don Rickles?
Yes, he is. I actually met him. Yeah, nice. But he's old. I mean, he's very, very old. He's like in his 90s.
He's still now. Got it, though, I think.
Oh, yeah. No, he's still sharp as a tack. It's just his body is just – I mean, if you watch him on talk shows right now, it's
– Wow. It's, his body was never anything to write home about anyway.
Oh, no. No. And I can tell you that.
Tim, how dare you?
I'm kidding. I think he would enjoy it.
I once met Bob Hope in a grocery store when I first moved out here, and the lights were on, but nobody was home. He was just standing in an aisle, and it was the saddest thing I've ever seen. Okay, back to the plugs.
Yeah,
I write the Raw reviews for Voices of Wrestling, and I also co-host Shake Them Ropes, which you can find at voices of wrestling/str, I think, or Shake Them Ropes, one of the two. And you can follow the show at Shake Them Ropes, all one word. Other than that, if you want to ask me anything, I'm always willing to talk on the internet. That's what I do.
Nice.
All right. Thanks, Jeff. Oh, do you have the Crap Game 13 name on PWO?
I think I'm Hawkins on PWO.
Okay. That was supposed to be at the beginning. I forgot that's one of my opening questions.
That's quite all right. If I have any posts on there, it's like one post, and I think it was from like 2 weeks ago.
All right. Well, either way, thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
No problem.